we know that some of the gospel writers copied from others. Therefore, if you eliminate that duplication, you would have probably about 20 pages left that tell us about the life and the teaching of Jesus through the Gospels. And of those 20 pages, 13 of them deal specifically with the last week of his life. And if you separate it still further, you'll discover that one third of those 13 pages took place on Tuesday of Holy Week. So in terms of sheer volume, we know far more on this day of Jesus' life than any other day. The events that day represent a significant percentage of what we know about the person of Jesus Christ. We know that Jesus spent Monday evening in Bethany, probably in the home of Mary and Martha and Lazarus, since that's where he spent Sunday evening. He rose early on Tuesday morning and he and his disciples returned to Jerusalem. And so if you will, let your mind drift back through the pages of history. Let us assume for a moment that you're living in that first century Palestine. It's a season of Passover, and you and your family, among thousands of religious pilgrims, have migrated to that ancient walled city to participate in the religious celebration. You were there on Monday when Jesus took a whip and radically ran the money changers from the temple. It had been a really eventful day. But now it's Monday evening and it's come time to retire with your family. And as you walk down the Villa della Rosa, you'll pass by the palace of the high priest, the residence of Caiaphas. And you'll notice there a light burning in that upper floor room of that mansion. You comment to your family that Caiaphas must be working long hours to see that all of the religious festivities go on as scheduled. Yet, if you only knew what was really going on in that place that evening, if you only knew what was taking place in that smoke-filled room, because gathered around the table that evening in the palace was one of the strangest combinations of political and religious factions that anyone could possibly imagine. Yet politics makes strange bedfellows. It's interesting to me to see how some Protestant denominations who have great difficulty with the Catholic Church find partnership with them on, say, the issue of abortion. It's interesting to see how some of the Protestant churches and the Jews are brought together because they have similar views on the protection of Israel. Groups that would not normally be in communication with one another are sometimes strangely brought together for a temporary goal. And that's what was taking place in this upper room. This is what was happening that night in Jerusalem. And here's the background. The three groups conspired together that evening: the Herodians, the Sadducees, and the Pharisees. Their common goal was to discredit Jesus Christ in front of his people and the common people. So who were these people? Well, the Herodians were people who were opposed to the present Roman procurator, Pontius Pilate. They wanted the restoration of the power of the throne of Herod under one of Herod's sons. The Sadducees, well, they were the conservatives. They were the aristocracy and the priestly class. Theologically, they did not believe in the afterlife. The Pharisees, who were numerically were the largest represented group, were in essence the liberals. Theologically, they did believe in the afterlife. And these three groups were indicative of what was happening in that land. They were a divided people. You know, the church is not much different today. But yet we have so much in common. Yet what those little things that divide us keep us apart. You know, for reasons both politically and theologically, they split, the Jews split, into many factions. Doesn't the church do the same today? Some believed in the appeasement of the Romans, some in mutual coexistence, some in silence, and some, like the Zealots, in outright armed rebellion. But there was one thing they all held in common. They hated and despised the present Roman procurator, Pontius Pilate. And if they had their preference, all they would want was out from under the rule of Rome. So the Jewish leadership viewed Jesus in the terms of his stance on the Roman issue. And with that in mind, listen to a few of Jesus' sayings. Go the second mile. Now, that was a reference to the Roman law that anyone could be pressed to assist a Roman soldier for 1 mile. But Jesus said, go the second mile. Turn the other cheek. That was a directive to avoid retaliatory behaviour. Pray for your enemies. What did he mean by that? Render unto Caesar. Well, that doesn't sound very Jewish, does it? And if you think politically, you can imagine the charge that would come from those teachings, that Jesus was soft on the Roman issue. A mix-up with all of this was the protection of the old traditions. It was hard for them to understand why people, or it was hard for us to understand why people would hate Jesus. We see him as a man who loved and healed, who was in essence a person of peace. But Jesus also challenged the old ways. His prediction of the destruction of the temple and the driving out of the money changers cast him as anti-establishment. So this conference was not called an attempt to plot to assassinate Jesus, but rather to discredit him. They didn't want a martyr on their hands. They would much prefer to make him a fool. Let's give him enough rope that he may just hang himself. I wonder whether we've heard that saying before. So each of the groups would in turn ask a question, not because they thought they could learn from him. They didn't think that they could learn from Jesus, that he could teach them anything. But they only wished to trick him. They were hoping for that one slip of the tongue. It's probably easier then than it is now with all the recordings that whatever you say is there for perpetuity. Each group was going to ask him a question that was dear to their cause. And the first question on that Tuesday was from the Herodians, since these were people who were politically and governmentally oriented. Their question dealt with the relationship of church and state. Scripture reads, pretending to be sincere, he asked the question of taxes and Caesar. Clearly it was a trick question. If Jesus said no, the Romans, on the grounds of treason, would arrest him quickly. If he said yes, he would enrage the masses who hated the Romans and particularly their tax. But what did Jesus do? He took a coin and asked whose picture was stamped on it. And then he said to them, if you remember, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. Well, it's still the same age-old question of God and government. Where do you draw the line? What I hear Jesus saying is that the government does have a legitimate claim upon your life and mine. But this is a part that we so often ignore, that God also has a claim upon our lives. And I realise that it's a fine line sometimes, and it's often something that we have to struggle with. And it may sound trite, but I'll try and give you an example. Today is seen as Defence Sunday. We've got a number of poppies and things here because we're coming to Remembrance Day. And Defence Sunday is a day we're encouraged to pray for our armed forces, for our troops. But friends, that's looking at prayer through the eyes of citizens. Because remember, just remember, that Jesus taught us to pray for our enemies as well. As Christians, we have a duty to do both. And for some, that's hard to deal with. And it doesn't matter which side you're on. Just take the issue of Israel and Palestine. One side is, you may find, much easier to pray for than the other. But God calls us to pray for both. As Christians, we have that duty to do both. And the message I think we should be trying to pray for is that God can bring peace into this world and harmony into this world. To me, that's more appropriate. The cross needs to come before our country. The cross must come before the soldier, because we are citizens of heaven, first and foremost, and of Australia, secondly. Should I pray for the Australian soldier? Yes, most definitely. Because at times, they do have to go to war on our behalf to defend us. But if I'm going to err, then I'd want to err in favour of God. You know, it is a delicate balancing act, and I admit that. And Jesus understood that it was delicate, and you can hear that in his careful answer. At times we have a duty to Rome, and other times a duty to God. You know, money that is to go to taxes cannot go to support the church. Try and argue that with the tax department. You won't succeed for very long, and you won't have the money enough to help the church. At any rate, Jesus sufficiently straddled the issue that the Herodians were not able to trap him. And next in the crowd stepped forth was a Sadducee. These are ones, you will recall, who didn't believe in the resurrection, and their question therefore dealt with the other world, the afterlife. And they asked Jesus a hypothetical question about a woman who was widowed seven times in succession. We had that today. In heaven, whose husband will she be? To them, this was a question that pointed out the total absurdity of the thought of afterlife from their perspective. And Jesus answered by saying, in the resurrection, people will neither marry nor will they be given in marriage. In other words, Jesus is saying that heaven is on a completely different dimension. It will not be there like it is here. There is no marriage. Jesus shows that what they have in the question that they asked was a faulty premise. Unlike the other answer that he gave, this was a very direct answer. But then Jesus goes on to address himself to the real issue that was being raised. And he said, God is a God of the living and not of the dead. So what did he mean by that? He's saying to the Sadducees, you're concerning yourself with the afterlife and the problem that the problem is that you have not learnt to live life here and now. Heaven is not our responsibility. That's God's responsibility. What is our responsibility is how we live our life here and now. The Sadducees were at a loss for words, and quietly they returned to their seats. And the third question comes from the Pharisees. They were the largest group represented. They were the guardians of the Torah, and so their question dealt with the law and man's relationship to the law. Master, they asked, which is the greatest commandment? And the pitfall there is obvious. To emphasise one particular law could be construed by the critics that you're de-emphasising all the other aspects of the law. But again, Jesus outflanks them. Quoting from the Shema, he says, love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength. And the second is like the first, love your neighbour as you love yourself. Love God, love man. Do that, implied Jesus, and you can toss out all the scribal laws and your religious lawyers too. And having routed the opposition, Jesus now, in essence, says, it's my turn. Now I want to ask you a question. What do you think of Christ? The question that Jesus posed remains to this day the most relevant, the most urgent, the most theological, and the most important issue confronting us. What do you think of the Christ? Because wherever we turn in life, we are faced with the implications of that question. What do you think of the Christ? You see, all of their questions dealt with man's relationship to mankind. Jesus' question deals with man's relationship with God. They were putting the cart before the horse. Today, the crowds are still asking the wrong questions and trying to find the right answers. We talk about pollution, race relations, wars, world hunger. And all the while we skirt around that $10 million question, what do you think of the Christ? There's a story told of a preacher attempting to put the finishing touches to his sermon, but was constantly interrupted by his six-year-old daughter. So to occupy her, he found a picture of the globe of the world, and he cut it up into little pieces, knowing that it would keep her busy for a long time to put it back together. But to his surprise, very quickly she had completed it. And asked how she did it so fast, she replied, simple, there was a picture of the man on the back, so I simply put his face together and the world fell right into line. And that is what Jesus is saying to them and to us on that Tuesday of that last week of his life. What do you think of the Christ? Put that picture together and the rest of your world will fall right into place. Amen.